Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, guys and girls. The program you are about to hear will be both fun and educational, but it is not a substitute for medical advice. Although we are doctors, we are not your doctors.
Hello, and welcome to Travel Medicine. As always, I'm your friendly neighborhood internal medicine doc, Dr. J.
Hey, y'all. This is Dr. Santosh coming at you. And actually, this is Dr. Santosh after dark. I mean, it's gotten dark, and then it got light again, and now it's kind of getting dark right now. This will make more sense in just a bit when we start getting into our, like, the meat of the episode. But
We're off to attack the Fire Nation. We're off to attack the Fire Nation, Santosh.
I, of all the things on this beautiful continent of ours, I think it would be the most, it would have been the most glorious thing if, and I haven't seen this online yet, if someone had just gone off and, like, you know, Civil War reenactment style, had done the eclipse episode of Avatar: The Last Airbender underneath the totality of the eclipse. I think it would have warmed my heart. I don't think it happened.
So, listening audience, we are going to be talking about the day of the Black Sun, which we really should have put this episode out a week ago, but, you know, here we are, and here you are, and so now is when you're getting it.
I'm kind of embarrassed. This is the first time ever that we have been late to an occasion. I defy you, Josh, to find another time when Travel Medicine Podcast.
Usually we're so punctual. Think of this as just prepping for the next eclipse.
But... oh, yeah. We're 25 years ahead of schedule? 20 years. Yeah,
so listening audience, this episode will cover, much like the eclipse, in totality...
Oh, hey, yeah.
Nothing but the sun. Well, maybe a little bit more. And you may be wondering, what could an eclipse possibly have to do with medicine? And if you're asking that, you are clearly not a salivating ophthalmologist.
Just waiting in the emergency room with your, you know, all of your tools just like ready to go in that big weird helmet looking thing that you use to look into people's eyeballs. Yeah.
So Santosh, did you get a chance to watch the eclipse?
Yeah. So I am. My home is in beautiful, sunny Southern California, and we were quite out of the way of the totality eclipse, where the moon directly eclipsed the sun. So I believe the you know, the greatest shade that we achieved was about 50%. But my wife, being an amazing aerospace engineer, did have a pair of eclipse glasses. And I did, at the peak of the eclipse, the most, you know, eclipsing that we could see from our side, which was about 50 to 60%. I was able to actually look up and see the moon in front of the sun. And it, even at 50%, it's beautiful to see. I've been told that under totality, it is a much more surreal, you know, kind of like earth-shaking experience for those who go through it.
Yeah, so I had a friend who was out in Mazatlan for totality, and that's very different. Over here in Chicago, I got to see 94% coverage, and let me tell you, that 7% makes a huge difference. So the 7% difference is huge, because out here in Chicago, we went from bright sunny day to slight cloud cover, whereas in Mazatlan, it really did look straight out of Avatar the Last Airbender. You know, I could see why ancient peoples would be worried that gods were eating the sun or omens of ill were being cast. And as long as we're talking about ancient civilizations, let's check in on Egypt, because in ancient Egypt, eyes were the most important organ, as they allowed perception of the real world. And of course, we've seen the Eye of Horus that appears in almost every version of ancient Egypt referenced pop culture.
Oh, yeah. Now, it's the kind of mascara looking eye with the two little sticks kind of coming out the bottom that looks like a, you know, a beautiful, sexy, you know, makeup surrounded eye type thing.
So of the eyes of Horus, one represents the moonlight dispersing the darkness of the night, and the other represents the sun that creates life. And both together represented the power of human intellect, which meant that blindness or disease-related congenital was considered a divine punishment, and Egyptian eye doctors carried a special kit that contained green chrysocolla and a black coal makeup, because those personified Osiris's humors or body fluids. So the ancient Egyptians were really tuned in to diseases of the eye, which made me wonder if, you know, the sun itself was supposed to be the Eye of Horus or the start of Ra. Did ancient people go blind from looking at eclipses? Because now, of course, we are going to get into folks who did stare at the sun without protective gear. But did this happen in the ancient world? What are your thoughts?
I can imagine if the eclipse, the event of the eclipse was this scary, mystical looking thing, right? Where you didn't have a good explanation for what was going on. And there were people who, you know, defied the rules and don't look up at the sky during an eclipse and that kind of a thing. And I'm guessing we're going to talk a little bit about the mechanisms of how this can hurt your eyes and such, but they're looking up at what they think is a dark area. And then, you know, hours, days later, all of a sudden, you know, they're blind. I can fully understand why that would appear like a curse, and that the person who was struck with the blindness, you know, appeared to have defied the edicts of, you know, a higher being or a heavenly being, you know, as the moon covered. For those of y'all who don't know, and, you know, as we said at the beginning of this episode, we're a bit late on this, but you should not look up at the circle of the sun during an eclipse. There's a tiny sliver of time where it's fairly safe when there's totality going on, but you're not good enough to tell the difference between totality and the moon either not fully covering or starting to move out of the way. And during that period of time, that sun will burn your retinas.
Wow, way to make it a personal attack, Santoshi. You're not good enough to tell when the sun's totally covered. Leave that to the professionals. So did this happen in ancient times? Well, it probably wasn't a mass blindness, as there weren't huge viewing parties. People, as you mentioned, considered this something of a religious significance, meaning you stayed indoors if the entire world went dark at midday. It wasn't the kind of thing you were staring up at the sky for. Now we do
unless
have,
you were, you know, unless you had mad hubris.
Now we do have an account from around 450 BC by Thucydides, who was a Greek who wrote the history of the Peloponnesian War. He did not believe most of the superstitions of the times. He thought the prophets were scam artists, that it didn't really have anything to do with the gods or omens of the future. And he does discuss eclipses for a couple paragraphs, but he also notes that even though I don't believe this, I think it's all superstition, a lot of Greeks who went outside during a solar eclipse had gone blind, so you probably should just stay indoors.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You also, if we skip ahead a few years, during the 15th to 18th centuries, so nice big chunk of time, you could easily identify navigators on ships because they would, without fail, all be blind in one eye.
Oh, this is the eye patch thingy.
Yeah, it wasn't just a fashion statement for pirates. It was how you would identify a navigator, because let's face it, it took a lot of time, somewhere around 300 years, to invent a sextant that would allow them to find the midday sun by looking at the shadow rather than directly at the sun.
Oh, I see. So this is eclipse or no eclipse. They'd be looking up because they'd have to spot the sun.
Because that's how you got from one place to another before we had GPS. Easiest way to identify a ship's navigator is look for the person who's partially blind.
Oh, okay. All right.
So there's nothing uniquely magical about eclipse radiation. When we say don't look at the sun, you should never look directly at the sun, eclipse or otherwise. So why do we make such a big deal of it during an eclipse?
Well, the short answer is, like I mentioned just a little while back, because it gets so dark, you get fooled and you think you can look up at the sun without harm. That's basically the long and short of it.
So let's go a little bit more into the long. Normally, we can't force ourselves to look at the sun for more than a split second. We have involuntary reflexes that force us to squint and look away. You'll really notice this if you're driving into the sunrise or sunset. That reflex will still work when only a bit of the sun is covered by the moon. But the issue here is that as the sun gets eclipsed, your pupils will begin to dilate to accommodate the dimmer light. But the sun is still giving pretty dangerous levels of ultraviolet, which means more gets into your eyes. Now, this wouldn't be an issue if you're still doing that squint reflex, but the real risk comes in when there's just a teeny bit of the sun's disk peeking out. It's not
the
bright
sliver.
Enough. Yeah, it's not bright enough to trigger that reflex, but there can still be enough infrared light to literally cook your retinas.
Ooh.
And you don't feel this happening because there are no pain receptors in your retina.
Yeah, it sounds like there should be, right? Because we use terms like, oh, the light hurts my eyes. No, what you're feeling is not pain. That's actually, if you were to look into a bright light, like if you have a lamp in your room or something like that for too long, or, if you wake up in the middle of the night and you someone clicks the lamp on it, you don't feel pain. You feel a shock of a sense, but that's light hitting your retina and forcing you to, kind of protect yourself. And it's a fairly complex loop, reflex loop that's established that way. You're absolutely right. Infrared is heat. That's the stuff that comes off of, fire, et cetera, like that. You can't see it with your eyes. I'm personally attacking them again, Josh. Yes, I'm talking about your eyes because you cannot see into the infrared part of the spectrum.
Someone but woke up today and chose violence.
No, I did. you can feel it on your skin because those will hit pain receptors and thermoreceptors. Neither pain receptors or thermoreceptors are available on the back of your eye, and the infrared, which you say, it should hurt the front of the eye, but no, the front of your eye is clear, son. So that infrared's just going straight on back to your peepers.
So we're going to devote the remainder of today's episode to talking about solar retinopathy, aka photic retinopathy, aka foveal macular retinitis, aka solar retinitis, and finally eclipse retinopathy. All fancy names for the same thing. What happens when you allow the sun to cook your eyeballs? This is typically associated with sun gazing or eclipse viewing, but it can also be caused by laser pointers, welding, and even microscopes or endo illumination during ophthalmic surgery.
You just need a really bright source of light. The sun is pretty much the brightest source of light that there is in our little universe, but you just need anything that's going to shine on to your eyes for way too long.
We start with how did and when did eclipse viewing become so popular? And actually, there were eclipse viewing parties even as early as the Victorian era, so I can hit my other favorite historical period.
Yay!
But mostly, it was a very small niche crowd, largely astronomers, who would look at this during the Age of Enlightenment and maybe have a couple friends over. But when the eclipse of July 11th, 1991 was going to take place, the National Geographic Society sent a team of scientists to Hawaii to report on the event. Now, National Geographic used to be a huge magazine for all us millennials back in the day.
Oh, yeah. I still have quite a few of my Nat Geos, and I really did love it. I think it got bought up by something or other, and it has not been the same since. But not only just amazing information and knowledge to be gained from that, but one of the best photojournalistic magazines that you'd find. Prize-winning, Pulitzer Prize-winning photographs have appeared in National Geographic.
And this was the first eclipse where people actually kind of put in the effort to go somewhere to see it, whether that's because it was by National Geographic or it was in Hawaii, who knows. But this did not result in widespread blindness because warnings were always part of a notification of a pending eclipse. But I'm sure that you know somebody who said, well, like, what if I just look for a couple seconds? Or or what if I wear sunglasses? Or no, what if I just hold my phone in front of my face? Or something to that effect. And the reason I know that you know somebody who's heard this is I had to have this lecture or this explanation at least 6 or 7 times in the hospital with my co-physicians.
Oh no.
They're like, well, did you bring I didn't bring eclipse glasses, because that's for nerds. You know, what if I just take a look for a couple seconds and I have to sit there and be like, you're my peer.
Yeah.
You should know better. Yeah.
This happens to us. And this is, by the way, one of the biases and the intellectual faults which can hit anybody who has studied for a long period of time, is you get it in your head that you are physically special because you've gotten a degree of some kind. It's somehow, you know, these basic rules of the universe don't apply to you. So I'm not terribly surprised. I'm a little disappointed.
I'm not going to name names, but I was very disappointed at the number of times I had to explain this to people who honestly should know better. So, and this is not an isolated incident because, again, it's a point of every eclipse that the scientists warn, hey, by the way, don't look directly at the sun. In Turkey, right, in 1976, 58 patients sought treatment for eye damage after an eclipse. While a few experienced initial improvements, the damage in others was unchanged even 15 years later.
Oh, no.
In 1999, 45 people presented to the Eye Casualty Center of Leicester Royal Infirmary after an eclipse in the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. Solar retinopathy was seen in 40 of them. 7 months later, 5 people could still see ghosts of damage in their visual field. So will you absolutely go blind? No. But do you want to be the one who gambles that you don't recover your vision?
Yeah. So, I mean, the chances don't look very good. And what you're mentioning here in the United Kingdom and Turkey, these kind of cases, I think the scariest thing is, you know, okay, fine, you didn't go blind, but you're left with this horrible defect in your vision. Like, you'll never, ever see clearly again.
But what does that mean? So we called it, remember, one of our AKAs was foveomacular retinitis. It's a lot of fancy terms there.
Yeah.
So your fine detail vision, the ability to distinguish, well, details, is handled by a tiny, tiny spot on your retina called the fovea. Normally, it kind of flits about and your brain assembles a detailed scene of what you're looking at. If you burn that puppy out, you will have 20/200 vision that cannot ever be corrected. No amount of lenses, laser surgery, nothing. Now, here's where the gambling, the people who say, well, I looked at the sun and nothing happened to me. A momentary glimpse of the sun will most likely hit outside the fovea, because as your eyes are making unconscious involuntary movements called saccades.
I've never figured out the proper pronunciation for this word. I've spoken to so many people. I think it's saccades, so, but I might be wrong.
We'll call it saccades. Your eyes
saccades is good.
Your eyes don't continuously track like a rollerball. What they do is a lot of jump cuts, and your brain takes those images and assembles them into one smooth picture. So because of all these jump cuts, looking at the sun will most likely hit outside the fovea, that fine detail vision. And even if it does, it will likely be too brief to do damage. But if you stare at the sun for any prolonged period, and there prolonged can mean even as many as 7 to 10 seconds, or you focus on a magnified image, such as looking through a camera, a telescope, this can damage your eyes. It increases the likelihood that the fovea will move into the path of the sunlight. As I said, there is no mysterious radiation that blinds people only during eclipses.
Yeah. What are the kind of areas we're talking about, right? So the macula, which is, you know, just on the kind of the, you know, inside of your optic disc, this is an area typically for a human eyeball about 5.5 millimeters in diameter. This is, it sounds super, super tiny, right? In the middle of the macula is the fovea centralis, which is, you're getting down to fractions of a millimeter, 0.5, 0.35, and then 0.15 millimeters, where this is a high, high concentration of the cone cells that pick up light and help interpret the image. When you're looking straight at something and you want to focus in on it and you want to get the most detail of an object, you are asking your eye with the lens and everything else to take in the area of your vision and zoom in down to, you know, 0.35 millimeters, that exact little spot that you want to kind of, you know, really focus on and understand the detail. And you have vision around the rest of your eye, but this part is super, super important. Okay. So imagine you burn out that area. You can't do that thing anymore where you focus on one spot. That focus spot will look like a blurry mess, and the rest of your vision will look the way that your peripheral vision looks, which is to say you can catch movement and such very, very well, but you're not going to be able to make out detail. And I don't care how close you move it to your face or whatever it is. This is not a problem like with your lens that you can fix with glasses. The actual cells, the receptors that pick up the light and send the signal to your brain, are fakakta.
It's basically donut hole vision, as in if you held a donut hole in front of your eye, you could only see the things around the edges. So what happens in this process? Well, you get phototoxicity or light damage when the UV or infrared energy in the light forms damaging free radicals. That reacts with the oxygen within the retina that's carried in your bloodstream. This then disrupts the retinal pigment epithelium. This is a layer of supportive cells beneath the retina, as well as the blood vessels. So these cells begin to fragment. Nerve cells within the retina that detect light and color, your rods and cones, then also basically implode, explode, however you want to think of it. And this results in a permanent loss of your central vision. Usually, the onset of symptoms does not happen. Like we said, you don't notice that you're doing this until it's already happened. So within hours to 1 to 2 days of exposure, you can start to notice your vision is blurred bilaterally, meaning both eyes or sometimes just one eye. You might notice a blind spot in the center of your vision or just off to the side. Your color vision may be altered. One of the more pathognomonic or definite indicators of this is visual distortion, meaning straight lines now start appearing curved or kinked. You have difficulty focusing, which is known as micropsia. So objects appear smaller than normal, as well as headaches and sensitivity to light.
Every stinking time you open your eyes, this is bad. Now, there are conditions where the macula gets harmed. And there, you know, there's autoimmune diseases like macular degeneration. There's diabetic retinopathy, which can affect the macula and then the fovea centralis in the middle of it. And, you know, these kind of avoidable things and unavoidable things. But this is something genuinely that every last one of us can completely avoid in terms of phototoxic, macular destruction. And I would argue, Josh, that in a lot of ways, it may even be preferable to have, you know, if you suffer something like this, you know, this type of macular damage from the sun, that it would almost be preferable just to not see, because the distorted kind of blotty, blurry vision that you're left with is so horrible. Now you can get used to it, quote unquote, and you can still make some use of the residual vision that you have, but I personally, I almost feel like I would maybe just rather be blind.
So one of the questions is, how did we actually learn that this is what happens to the eye when damaged by the sun?
Oh, this isn't going to turn into one of those self-experimentation thingers, is it?
No, but it is really interesting.
Oh, okay. Yeah, hit me.
In 1993, Hope Ross et al. Studied ultrastructural pathologic changes of solar retinopathy. They're like, okay, we know that people can go blind from staring at the sun, but what's actually happening? How did we learn about that whole spiel of info I just dumped on you earlier?
Sure. Yeah.
So the research team of Hope and Ross enlisted the cooperation of a 65-year-old man scheduled for enucleation for choroidal melanoma, meaning they found somebody who had to have his eyeball scooped out.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Out due to cancer.
Got it.
The patient agreed to stare into the sun 6 days prior to the removal of his eye. He's like, listen, I'm not going to be using this anymore. So sure, for science, you want me to look directly into the sun? fine.
Okay. I'm hoping that there was like a pile of paperwork signed.
They were taking the eye out anyway. He's like, oh no, I've lost my vision in the eye that you're scooping out of my skull.
I get it. I understand. But there are ethical implications here still.
What are the ethical implications? Hey, you're losing the eye anyway. You mind if we take a look at it? Would you do us a favor? Just go ahead and look up. Listen, you know you want to. Just do it. Do it and give us your eyeball.
This is a little bit of the equivalent of like, oh man, you're gonna lose your hand. Do you mind just like setting it on a stove? Just like, we want to see what burn damage is like.
Have you not been paying attention? Your eyeball doesn't have pain receptors in the retina.
No, but it's still, you know, you're asking a person to go through some degree of suffering here, so.
You're right. It's unfair. Okay. Would you stare at the sun for a couple seconds, which could be maybe painful with this non-pain receptor, right before we dig your eye out of its skull?
Okay.
So anyway, the finding, that's how we learned about a lot of these findings of the eye on autopsy. Of the eye, the guy was fine. Included photoreceptor changes, including vesiculation or bubbling. That's how we know your eyeballs are getting cooked. Fragmentation of photoreceptors, the presence of whorls within disc membranes. That's where you're getting those kinked lines. Mitochondrial swelling, and the retinal pigment cells in the affected area actually showed plasma membrane changes down to the level of cell structures, like the endoplasmic reticulum, one of my favorite cell organelles to say.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, we think about the cell membrane, you know, usually the lipid bilayer that's on the outside. But all of our organelles inside of our cells, a lot of them have a, you know, their own, you know, limiting membrane on them. So those can likewise get damaged and bleb and cause swelling like inside of the actual cell.
So there are a couple risk factors that can make this damage even worse or make you more likely to get permanent as opposed to temporary sun damage. So some of these predisposing factors include things like photosensitizing drugs. We've talked in the past about antibiotics like tetracycline that make you more sensitive to light and sunburns. Usually we're talking about it in a skin context, but it does mean that you are much more sensitive to eye injuries from bright lights. Also, if you're on drugs known to cause macular toxicity, that central area of the eye, an example of that is Plaquenil, which is used for rheumatoid arthritis, lupus. Yeah. You may also know it by the name hydroxychloroquine.
Yeah. So the medicine which you should not be taking for COVID, because the people who actually need it to treat their autoimmune disease need it.
Yeah, but it can also lead to heightened risk of sun damage. Psychiatric disease is a risk factor. Because apparently people with certain kinds of mental illness are more likely to look directly at the sun, to ignore that reflex that tells us to look away. For unknown reasons.
Sure.
Illicit drug use. If you're tripping the light fantastic on any kind of hallucinogen and staring out at hallucinations or what you think is a spirit guide or just the weird things that these drugs can do to you, you are not going to be thinking about looking away from bright sources of light. And of course, pre-existing macular disease. One of the interesting ones, young children. Much more at risk from light damage than adults. And Santosh, do you know why that is?
So there is a degree of experience that you have to, you know, actually know to look away. The light reflex, you know, like what you're talking about, the squinting reflex is a reflex itself. But the truth of the matter is, you know, the eyes are basically a bit immature in those kids in terms of, you know, blocking out certain rays.
Yeah, so children are at high risk because their eyes transmit more light to the retina than adult eyes, which, are you ready to feel old? Adult eyes, as we age, start to form cataracts, which are slightly cloudy areas, which do have a minimal protective effect. That doesn't mean that Pop-Pop, with his completely overclouded cataract eyes, can stare directly at the sun. He wouldn't be seeing anything anyway. But it does mean that he would be much less likely to develop permanent solar retinopathy than a child with the same amount of exposure, because those cataracts are going to refract the light and help provide a minimal protective effect.
Okay, so cataracts are horrible. They suck to live with. But in this particular case, if the elderly person happened to have cataracts and they, let's say, accidentally looked up at the sun, or, you know, ignored some advice of using eclipse sunglasses, then they'd have a little bit less of a chance of that phototoxicity hitting the macula, the fovea, and other, you know, still like out of vital areas of the retina. But still, time is a factor. The longer that a person's going to stare up there, these quote-unquote protective factors are going to wear.
One brief aside I want to talk about, because we are focusing mostly on the sun, but as long as we're bringing up kids and things you shouldn't do, laser pointers. Do you remember when we were growing up, the huge fad for laser pointers and the constant warning, stop playing with those, you'll put someone's eye out?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Is it, and then, you know, inevitably when the parents were out of the room, the lasers would go on and say things like, pew, pew.
So researchers have studied the effects of laser pointers to the eyes for pew. Years. And the lights on some lasers are stronger than others. So all you need is an output power of 5 milliwatts or more to permanent damage to the retina, even after a few seconds of exposure. Also, blue and violet colored lasers are far more dangerous than red or green lasers because your eyes are less sensitive to blue or violet. You may not turn away as fast from a blue or violet laser, which gives it more time to harm your eye, which sounds counterintuitive.
Yeah, you may actually see, if you look at any documentaries, anything where you're watching a physicist study phenomenon using lasers, you know, for any and all of the experiments that they use, you're supposed to always have a set of protective glasses which actually diffract or scatter the laser light should the laser light come and, you know, over and hit your eye. And in the lab, Josh, I'll actually tell you that there's actually an entire safety class when working with lasers of, you know, just saying over and over, keep your glasses on, you know, and don't look directly into the laser. Those are the only two lessons, and it's a half an hour class.
Not nearly long enough. So that's the modern world with lasers and sunlight. But again, back to our ancient world, we have something that
Are you going to talk about ancient lasers? Because I thought we were saving that for another episode.
You know, that would bring us to the Greek history and the death ray of Archimedes.
Oh, yeah.
But we're not going to get into that today. No.
We have to figure out how to make that medically relevant first, but more to come.
I was going to circle back to ancient Egypt because there was something that a lot of ancient Egyptians wore that has carried through even to today around the Mediterranean that I think is worth studying. Now, I want to be very clear. It did not or would not have prevented eclipse damage directly to the retina. But, and here's the interesting thing, are you familiar with coal?
C-O-A-L, like the rock that you burn?
No, with K-O-H-L, also called surma. It is the dark... it's kind of the dark eye makeup that you think of when you picture a stereotypical ancient Egypt, like Cleopatra or or those like that dark, almost, I don't know, football like mascara around the eye.
Yeah, yeah, like eye black, like the smoky eye of ancient times, like the smokiest of smoky eyes.
Yeah. Now, it's a controversial cosmetic because it does have a little bit of lead in it, and smearing lead on your body, less than ideal.
I don't see the controversy.
Well, controversial because it includes lead, but it's still used today.
Oh, got it. Okay. So as in how safe is it? Yeah,
right.
Got it. Okay.
So, but again, this has been used since ancient times, and Egyptians were notorious for living in a fairly sun-rich environment.
Yes. Famously so, yes.
So modern research shows that this coal forms a very thin film on the eye lens, which means it helps to avoid the direct contact of harmful UV radiation, as well as cutting down the glare of the sun with the lens. A lot of this, when they analyzed the chemical composition, had to do with a mineral known as galena, along with lead. And this galena and lead and these other minerals in this coal eye makeup shields the eyes from the glare and reflection of the sun. And because you get this micro coating on the lens, protects from the harmful effects of UV radiation.
Ooh. Oh my gosh. Okay. So, all right. These ancient Egyptians knew what they were doing.
Yeah. So that's why you don't hear a lot about random sun blindness throughout ancient Egypt.
Like all the time.
Yeah. Again, okay. This does not mean you can go and smear some ancient Egyptian eye makeup on and not wear your glasses.
Yeah.
But this is one of the methods that ancient peoples, at least in that region of the world, would have used that it turns out did serve a protective effect, not just a cosmetic one.
Cool. Okay. Medically important makeup.
Yeah.
Which we have talked about before.
So, treatment and recovery. What happens if you do get solar retinopathy? You went out, you looked at the eclipse, you're listening to us now, and you're like, you know what? It turns out my vision is a little blurry or dark or gone. Sad news. No treatment, just prevention. Now, eclipse glasses should be... We'll talk about eclipse glasses in a moment, but the visual prognosis of solar retinopathy is usually favorable, mostly because your eye has adapted over centuries and millennia of evolution to protect you from some degree of photochemical damage, which means in most cases, visual loss is at least partly reversible.
Yeah, not... If you go for the wrong amount of time in the wrong area of your eye, you know, that energy hits, then you're going to be in a lot of trouble. But just like, a sunburn, if it's a mild damage, if it's quick enough, if it's in the, the more peripheral areas of your eye, which are, you know, important for vision, but not for that focused, you know, central vision, then there's ways for your eye and your brain to work together to get around it. And on occasion, the cone cells, the ones that would be damaged, they're not damaged quite enough that they die completely, that they can kind of bounce back.
Recovery is spontaneous in nature. It's a little bit of a crapshoot, and it will occur over the course of 3 to 6 months. As I said, maybe incomplete, you may have permanent visual acuity defects, you may have central or paracentral scotoma, so little dark spots in your vision that never go away, and there's no way to know. So the main treatment is, if you're noticing these kind of visual changes we've talked about, which again is any kind of loss of central vision, persistent blurry vision, straight lines looking kinked or wavy, sudden alterations in your color vision, get yourself to an ophthalmologist post haste, because they need to be able to take a look and tell you, you know, is this just some vasogenic edema? You know, do you just have a little bit of puffiness or buildup of fluids as a reaction to injury, or have you actively burned your eye out? So the main treatment is prevention, And that's done with eclipse glasses. So how long have eclipse glasses been around? Because we talked about ancient Egyptian eye makeup, but when did we start looking directly at the sun and realizing we needed something to protect ourselves with?
It sounds like we've known it for a very long time. I mean, we've called it as, you know, superstition or religious things or whatever. It sounds like a lot of different civilizations understood that, you know, it's bad to do this.
Mostly it dates back to the Renaissance when we started learning, you know, as people started staring at celestial bodies, they realized they did need some sort of protection. But in the very first telescopic viewing of a full solar eclipse, that was King Louis the 14th of France,
okay,
who wanted to see it, covered his telescope's lens with a piece of smoked glass to dilute the harmful light.
Oh, very, very smart. Okay. You know why Louis the 14th was the best one, you know, to do this, right? Because he was the Sun King.
I wonder if this is why he got that name.
I think it might have been a little, you know, self-put of like Le Roi Soleil is, you know, he was a little grandiose talking about like, oh, you know, you're all my people and I am your son type of thing. Like,
don't look directly at me without glasses.
Now, some of this kind of went along with this. Absolutely. There was this whole thing of like divinity going along with kinghood, but that's a separate thing. But yeah, he was known for advancing, you know, not just beauty and culture and art, but also science. During, you know, one of the heights of France's, you know, advancement. So, wow. Okay. So, he understood to use a protective cover over the, what do you call it? The telescope lens, huh?
Yeah. So he would not burn his eyes out because again, remember from the 15th to the 18th centuries, navigators were known and identified by being partially blind. So yeah. This smoked glass method remained popular throughout the early 19th century. Mm-hmm. And then we started getting the eclipsoscopes, pinhole cameras, a whole host of different ways as viewing eclipses became more popular. But these were not foolproof methods. Even with this protection, you could still get this solar retinopathy. In fact, an article published in 1947 in the Journal of School Health describes vision issues suffered by 32 children, an educational class, who used smoked glass to view the eclipse as it passed over Los Angeles and still got eye injuries even with the correct protective gear. And he basically concluded that smoked glass, film, and dark sunglasses don't provide sufficient eye protection. And that's where we get sort of the NASA international standard. When you look at the glasses, they should say ISO. I think it's 12315. Don't hold me to that, but it is NASA does put out the specific filter that
so
you should
it
be
is
looking at.
ISO 12312-2.
Okay. And NASA's released a list of acceptable vendors because, of course, some people will do anything to make a buck. And there are folks selling on Amazon ones that are not the correct filter or say they're the correct filter and still aren't. And those can cause damage. And no matter how much you sue the offending company, you will not get your vision back. So
and on the buy, these don't have to be expensive, you know, super, you know, expensive glasses and stuff. The ones that I used yesterday look like the old, you know, the cheapy 3D glasses that we used to get in the 1980s. But just in the slot where you had the eye was the proper filter in there. So yeah, don't go for, oh my gosh, this thing costs like $100 or something. These can be as cheap as like, you know, $1 or some places close to NASA facilities hand them out for free.
So does Warby Parker, most local libraries, every planetarium on Earth.
Yeah.
So current eclipse lenses are made from either mylar or black polymer, which is a resin that has carbon particles, which is used for all sorts of filters. And the way you can check is you should be testing your glasses before you look at the eclipse. You should put them on, and first you should see nothing. Then you can look at a lamp or a light bulb to ensure that when it's on, it can't be seen. The only thing you should be able to view through eclipse glasses is the actual sun. It should be too dark and obscure to see anything else other than the sun.
Yeah, and it takes a massive amount of light to cut through this particular filter. And if you've achieved that, then you've got it right.
And that's because these glasses reduce the sun's brightness by about 500,000 times compared to regular sunglasses, which only reduce sunlight by a factor of around 5 to 7.
So you're 100,000 times shy if you're trying to use like bog standard sunglasses.
Which is why, for my colleagues in the back, you can't look at the eclipse even if you're wearing sunglasses.
Oh, Lord Almighty.
Yeah. So that is it. Hopefully we have enlightened you. Oh, you know, one last thing. As long as we started the episode off with talking about Avatar: The Last Airbender, they did have an episode where they looked at the eclipse following all the appropriate precautions, but interestingly, they used a version of essentially Inuit snow glasses, things that are used to prevent snow blindness.
Yeah, so there are versions, you know, just like we're talking about with phototoxicity, where you don't look at the sun. When you live up in northern climes, you know, if you're a native person whose, you know, peoples lived in, you know, just below the Arctic Circle or around there, and it was just snow all the time. Even if you're looking straight ahead or down, you're basically looking at a giant mirror that's throwing all this light into your eye, and that's just as damaging over long periods of time. So you actually have to protect your eyes just when you're going out in the day so you don't get what's called snow blind. There are versions of this as well in desert climates because, you know, the sand, when it heats up, acts like a mirror, you know, that layer of air on top that looks like a mirage, where you can have sand blindness and, you know, out in the mountains and stuff like that too, where you really, you know, have to protect your eyes, even if you're not actually looking at the sun.
So I wonder, and I do not advocate testing this unless we have another 65-year-old man about to get enucleated, if... sure. If Inuit snow goggles, which served as the inspiration for Avatar: The Last Airbender, I wonder if Inuit snow goggles would be an acceptable alternative to view an eclipse, even without the filter, because it does narrow the field and amount of sunlight that can penetrate your eye, while also focusing your vision to give you better viewing of distant targets. That was their main purpose, to limit eye damage and increase visual acuity. I wonder if they would be useful for blocking an eclipse. I wasn't able to find any studies. And it just says they were inspired by NASA goggles, who were in turn inspired by Inuit goggles, and it turned into a whole snake eating its own tail of self-congratulation on design and not a lot of science.
Yeah, I think very specifically, this is meant to shade out reflected light, you know, when you're basically looking for what you're hunting for in the snow, you know, and you're out on a giant snowpack. It does not actually reduce the amount of light overall if you're looking at something like the sun. I would venture to guess that it's not a good idea to use these for looking at the eclipse. Even though the inspiration itself was kind of smart, you There was a line in Avatar: The Last Airbender. I almost said Airblender. Putting the glasses on, it says, even with your eclipse glasses on, don't look directly at the sun. I believe that's true. I have to look back at it, but it was a shout out not only to the characters, but to, you know, people watching the show, especially kids.
That is delightful. So hopefully all the firebenders managed to survive the most recent day of the Black Sun. Hopefully all of you listening at home got a chance to see it, and ideally without any eye injuries. But
yeah,
either way, again, follow up with your ophthalmologists, your eye docs, if you are noticing any of those. And that's it for this week. As always, we love to hear your comments, questions, and feedback. If you'd like to support us spiritually, emotionally, or financially, links to do that are in the show notes, along with links for further reading. You can also follow us on Acast Plus and find out about live performances and other cool stuff we do, you know, when we're not busy doctoring and looking at the sun. And until next time, as always, keep a song in your heart, soap on your hands, a shot in your arm, shades on your eyes, a spin on your globe. When you've done all that, figure out where the next eclipse is going to appear, plan out your trip, and happy travels.
Bye, everybody.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.